HPPodCraft.com.
Hushed were the streets of many peopled Thebes. Those few who passed through them moved with the shadowy fleetness of bats near dawn, and bent their faces from the sky as if fearful of seeing what in their fancies might be hovering there. Weird, high-noted incantations of a wailing sound were audible through the barred doors. On corners, groups of naked and bleeding priests cast themselves repeatedly and with loud cries upon the rough stones of the walks. Even dogs and cats and oxen seemed impressed by some strange menace and foreboding, and cowered and slunk dejectedly. All Thebes was in dread, and indeed there was cause for their dread and for their wails of lamentation. A terrible sacrilege had been committed. In all the annals of Egypt, none more monstrous was recorded.
You know that something heavy has happened when even the dogs and cats are impressed.
Groups of naked and bleeding priests? No big deal.
Nah, that's not a big deal. There's a group of priests outside the window right now throwing themselves down on the sidewalk. I can see them. There's a group of school kids stepping right over them. Nobody cares. But dogs and cats, even oxen, slinking dejectedly? They must have heard that the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast is coming to an end with this episode number 601.
An end and a new beginning.
Yes.
We're not missing a beat, and we'll be back next week with episode one of Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Our Patreon subscribers won't know anything's happening.
The only difference is that we'll be starting a new feed for the free monthly episodes at strangestudies.com, starting with episode one. We're expanding our scope a bit, and we'll talk more about that on our first episode, what exactly we mean by strange stories. Again, subscribers, you'll continue to get six shows a month uninterrupted. You'll have the whole back catalog here on Patreon, and you'll just continue to hear me introduce myself as Chad Pfeiffer.
You'll also hear me, Chris Lackey. We're going to be talking about all sorts of kick-ass short stories in science fiction, fantasy, and of course, horror and weird fiction genres.
And as the man wrote, that which is not dead can eternal lie. The HP Podcraft site, those free shows, all the back catalog, as I said, will still be available. And we'll be returning under the Lovecraft Podcast title here and there to update when something of Lovecraftian relevance comes up.
Speaking of which, today's reader is none other than Andrew Lehman of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. The folks at the HPLHS have just released the Call of Cthulhu Classic Gamer Prop Set, and it is amazing.
Yes, to celebrate the role-playing game Call of Cthulhu's 40th anniversary, Chaosium has republished a box set featuring some classic supplements from the game's early days, and the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society has taken those scenarios and created a collection of deluxe, ultra-realistic props for all of the scenarios. The set includes 94 props named in the supplements, plus a whole bunch more.
We'll link out to it in the show notes. This box set has got maps, letters, newspaper clippings, pages from horrifying books. You've got to buy it to believe it.
Even dogs and cats and oxen are raving about this box set. Also from Chaosium, the physical print edition of your book.
Yes.
The Cults of Cthulhu is finally out.
It's out. It's out in stores. I heard some folks are having trouble getting it from their distributors, but it's on its way. So if it's not there yet, it's going to be there really soon. I'm really excited about it.
That might be why the priests are freaking out on the corner right now. I got to admit, I've cast myself down on the rough stones a bit with excitement for this.
You and me both, buddy.
Again, thank you, Andrew Lehman, for reading on this episode and being such a good friend and collaborator over the last 13 years of the show. It was June of 2009 when we kicked this off. It's been one of the great loves of my life, this show. Yes. Our listeners, whom I also think of as collaborators, are the coolest, kindest, funniest people. Thank you, everybody, for being on board with us, and I hope you'll come along on the next leg of the journey.
They told me to take an Egyptian soulless ship named Desire and then transfer to one called Cemetery and ride at 6 knots and get off at Elysian Fields.
Why, is that Blanche DuBois from A Streetcar Named Desire?
It sure is, because today's story is by an author named Tennessee Williams. What?
Yeah, how about that? This story, The Vengeance of Nitocris, was published in Weird Tales in 1928. Lovecraft was obviously a contributor to and voracious reader of that magazine, so he no doubt read this, which was the first professional work ever published by one of our greatest American playwrights, Tennessee Williams. He was 16 years old when this came out. Wow. And he got paid a whopping $35 for the story, which actually is about $500 in today's money.
Wow.
I'm right now renting a house from some professors at the university here before Heather and I move into more permanent quarters this August. This house is packed with books. Mm. I was flipping through one that was just called The Pulps. It's edited by Tony Goodstone. I naturally flipped right to the section on the supernatural pulps that featured stories by our old friends Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith, Robert E. Howard, Frank Belknap Long. That chapter was kicked off by this story. It's said by Tennessee Williams. And I thought, what the heck? In the spirit of expanding our pool of authors, this could be a great transitional story, if not exactly a great story. And so I gave it a read. I liked it. Yeah. So what do we know about Tennessee Williams?
Well, he was born Thomas Lanier Williams III in 1911 in Columbus, Mississippi. He grew up with a traveling shoe salesman and abusive father who suffered from alcoholism. Mm. As a child, Williams almost died of diphtheria, and it left him in ill health for some time after that. And his father thought that Williams was effeminate, and he hated him for it.
Well, this was published under the byline Thomas Lanier or Lanier Williams. So he wasn't Tennessee yet. Now that I think about it, Indiana Jones is kind of a ripoff of Tennessee Williams, isn't it?
I never thought of it, but yeah.
Well, this is sort of like The Last Crusade. We're seeing the origins of Tennessee Williams here, played by River Phoenix.
He started writing at an early age. He won third prize in a writing contest when he was 16, and he had this story published in Weird Tales of August 1928. Even at an early age, you can tell that this guy had the goods.
Yeah, definitely. So I was reading this article about the story on Lit Hub. It says, as Francesca M. Hitchcock points out in Mississippi Quarterly, this story was not a hit. Dennis Venata in Tennessee Williams, A Study of the Short Fiction, evaluates The Vengeance of Nitocris as, quote, just about the way one would expect a 16-year-old contributor to Weird Tales to write.
Aww.
Almost uniformly cliched, strained, and dreadful.
Aww.
And Donald Spotto, one of Williams' biographers, noted the story's patent lack of poetic diction. Less than stellar reviews, but Tennessee Williams himself stands by the work. 30 years after the story's publication, Williams said this in the New York Times, I was 16 when I wrote The Vengeance of Nitocris, but already a confirmed writer, having entered upon this vocation at the age of 14. And if you're well acquainted with my writing since then, I don't have to tell you that it set the keynote for most of the work that has followed. And the story does prefigure themes found in Williams' later plays. The tale features a strong female protagonist, possibly affected by madness, mm-hmm. and a brother-sister relationship is central to its plot. Mm-hmm. A psychic bond of reciprocity between brother and sister is a theme that appears in several of Williams' later works, including the two-character play, Outcry, and to some extent, even The Glass Menagerie. Mm. The story also reflects Williams' long-standing interest in Shakespeare. Williams noted that he was 10 years old when he began being interested in blood and guts Shakespeare, and that his favorite Shakespeare play was Titus Andronicus, The Revenge Tragedy. Williams' Nitocris has been called the first of a long series of Cleopatra figures appearing in his works, the result of his early reading of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. Mm. That's actually one of my favorite Shakespearean plays as well. Yeah. It rarely gets produced, but it's awesome. These figures go on to include Blanche DuBois, whom you just so embodied mm-hmm. excellently in your earlier quote.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, Tennessee wrote and worked a series of jobs. He dealt with depression, having a nervous breakdown when he was only 24 years old.
Jeez.
He got a play called Battle of Angels made in Boston in 1940, but it was not well received. And it wasn't until 1945 that he got a hit with The Glass Menagerie. And then his next play, A Streetcar Named Desire, was a hit as well. And then he was on fire with Summer and Smoke in 1948, The Rose Tattoo in 1951, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in 1955, Orpheus Descending 1957, Guard District 1958, and Sweet Bird of Youth 1959. Oh my gosh, so many plays. And by 1959, he had earned 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 3 New York Drama Critics Circle Awards, 3 Donaldson Awards, and a Tony.
He ran that decade, man.
He did.
Again, the brother-sister thing turns up in a lot of these plays. I was reading something else by Francesca Hitchcock, and let me read this to you. It says, throughout his literary career, when asked about quote-unquote love, Tennessee Williams almost always answered with an explanation about his relationship with his sister, Rose. He called their love the deepest of their lives, a love that precluded the need for extra-familial attachments. Mm. Various friends of Williams saw the connection between Tom and Rose as so close that they appeared as two halves of a whole person. Harry Raske, author of Tennessee Williams, A Portrait in Laughter and Lamentation, writes that, quote, just as Siamese twins may be joined at the breastbone, Tennessee was joined to his sister Rose by the heart. A blending of two souls was so complete that they could have occupied a single body. Tom and Rose, called, quote, the couple by their maid Ozzy, had such a psychological affinity that when Rose had a cold or tonsillitis or mumps, Tommy was convinced he too was ill. According to Williams, his and Rose's relationship was an exclusive one. My sister and I grew so used to being company for each other that we tended to rely on each other's companionship rather than seeking friends. So that's a pretty deep relationship in his real life between the brother and sister. And so it makes sense that it would pop up a lot including this story.
Now, in the 60s, he had his own problems with alcoholism and depression as well, so it started to take a downturn for him. Williams was gay, and he had a long-term relationship with Frank Merlo, who was an actor and later became Williams' personal assistant. But the alcohol and infidelity ended their relationship after 14 years. But when Merlo died in 1968, that's when things really began to fall apart for Williams. He still produced a lot and wrote, but he never hit that status that he had in the 1950s. Williams died in 1983 of a drug overdose at the age of 71.
Wow.
And I think it can be said that Tennessee Williams is one of the greatest American playwrights ever.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's get into the story, The Vengeance of Nitocris. We start with a chapter heading, chapter one, Osiris is avenged. And then that very dramatic opening paragraph that we heard Andrew read.
Now, it seems that the priests are upset, which is upsetting everybody else, because some sacrilege has been committed. It seems that the altar to the god Osiris has been left for 5 days with no fires lit upon it.
No bigger sacrilege has ever been recorded in the history of Egypt, it says. Like putting this fire out, which is pretty incredible.
People are waiting for some great calamity to befall the land, as Osiris must want vengeance for such an act.
Now, I've gotten most of my Egyptian history from the 2016 film Gods of Egypt. I know that Osiris in that movie is played by FX and FX2 star Brian Brown, but I really couldn't remember much else about Osiris, so I had to look it up. I decided to look it up on the Canadian Museum of History website, because why not?
Yeah.
It says Osiris is one of the principal Egyptian gods who first appeared in funerary texts during the Pyramid Age, when the practice of mummification began. This is around 2400 BC. He presided over the court that determined the fate of kings when they died. He is portrayed as a mummified man wearing a tall white crown adorned with two ostrich feathers. According to Egyptian mythology, Osiris was murdered by his brother Seth, then brought back to life by the love of his sister and wife, Isis. This myth describes the forces of destruction that initiated the process of mummification. The love of Isis is a symbolic regeneration and the promise of eternal life. The cycle of destruction, death, and rebirth was repeated each year in the annual flood of the Nile, the river that provided the essential ingredients needed to sustain life, giving birth to one of the first civilizations. As we know, Osiris and Isis had a son named Horus, I believe played by Jamie Lannister in that movie. together, they represent a holy family, god, goddess, and divine child. In the New Kingdom, the main temples throughout Egypt venerated a holy family modeled on the Osiris, Isis, and Horus triad. So there you go. It's a huge sacrilege to let the fires go out in the temple of Osiris because he is a very big deal.
So who performed this sacrilege? The Pharaoh. It seems he had this bridge that he was making some slaves build for him when a flood swept in and busted up the whole thing. Osiris, he really dropped the ball on this one, so the Pharaoh was ticked and wanted to show his displeasure for such an incompetent god.
Whole years of death and famine had been known to result from such an offense, meaning, you know, the offense of putting the flames out at the temple.
Yes.
And I assume that those whole years of death and famine were just because a wind swept out and blew this thing out. To do that on purpose is really asking for it.
Oh, my goodness.
For a great calamity to befall. They were afraid a mighty earthquake would shake the city to the ground, or a fire from heaven would sweep upon them. A hideous plague, perhaps, or, as Tennessee Williams writes, some monster from the desert, where wild and terrible monsters were said to dwell. Let the record show that Tennessee Williams is writing about desert monsters in his very first story. But it's not just the extinguishing of the flames. Pharaoh was even meaner about this. It says he had defiled the hallowed altars with the carcasses of beasts. Even it was said in low, shocked whispers. In a mock ceremony of worship, he had burned the carrion of a hyena, most abhorrent of all beasts to Osiris.
Ooh.
I wish I could hear what a low, shocked whisper sounds like.
It's lost.
It's lost.
The annals of time. Even though he's the Pharaoh, the priests agree that his death is the only way to appease Osiris. So it's angry mob time, mob justice.
Within an hour, a well-organized mob passed through the streets of Thebes, directed for the palace of the Pharaoh.
The Pharaoh sees the mob coming, but he's not impressed. He's the Pharaoh. They are dogs. His sister, Nitocris, begs him to take this seriously, but he's not having it. He says, open the doors, let these punks in, and I'll show them what for.
Pretty cool. I'm not normally a big fan of royalty, but the Pharaoh was winning me over just with his confidence.
Yeah.
His disdain for the common man was infectious.
The Pharaoh draws his sword, and he goes to the top of the steps, and he is unflinching. He strikes this pose that makes the mob pause. The mob, led by the black-robed priests and nobles who had arrived at the foot of the steps, now fell back before the stunning, magnificent defiance of their giant ruler. They felt like demons who had assailed the heavens and had been abashed and shamed by the mere sight of that which they had assailed. A hush fell over them. Their upraised arms faltered and sank down. A moment more, and they would have fallen to their knees.
Superbly tall and muscular, his bare arms and limbs glittering like burnished copper in the light of the brilliant sun, his body erect and tense in his attitude of defiance.
But just as they're about to back down, the crumbling steps that the Pharaoh is standing on break under his foot, and he doesn't fall exactly. It says he was palpitating, wavering in the air, fighting to retain his balance. He looked as if he were grappling with some monstrous, invisible snake coiled about his gleaming body. A hoarse cry burst from his lips, his sword fell, and then his body thudded down the steps in a series of wild somersaults and landed at the foot, sprawled out before the gasping mob. For a moment, there was breathless silence. Then came the shout of a priest.
A sign from the god! That's so cartoonish. His arms, you know, palpitating in the air, trying to, and whoa, whoa, whoa!
I did laugh when I read that.
A series of wild somersaults. I didn't expect it to just be a pratfall that killed the pharaoh. But, you know, the steps are old and falling apart. It says the gold-sandaled foot descended on a step that was not strong enough to sustain his great weight. You know what this actually reminded me of, and I didn't expect it? The comic tumble down the steps from the movie The Naked Gun. There's a shot in there where Priscilla Presley makes her entrance, and she's so beautiful and at the top of these stairs, and then she just falls down the stairs. It's just a great comic moment, and this is that, but in ancient Egypt.
So they take it as a sign from God that he's fallen, and the mob descends upon the pharaoh and rips him apart. Osiris is avenged.
That gets us into the next chapter. A pharaoh is avenged, is what this is called.
Okay, now we know what's coming. Obviously, the pharaoh is going to be avenged. Mm-hmm. The rest of the story has really no twists or turns. It's just a slow, slow burn that gives you exactly what's on the tin.
Yeah, and no problems for me on this end. When I read the description of the story, I thought, oh, this is going to be maybe sort of a Hop Frog, Amontillado, Poe type of revenge story. I'm guessing that Williams read those. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is, although Poe was a little more crafty in how these things were executed, just sort of seeing the plan come together, whereas this plan is pretty simple. But there's something to be said for good blood and guts revenge.
Yeah.
And that something is cool.
Now, after the pharaoh's murder, Nitocris is made the successor. The priest and the people, they all love her. She's beautiful, pious, and wise. During the coronation rituals, she plays it cool. She seems gracious and kind, but she is secretly thinking, these are the people who slew my brother. Ah, God Isis, grant me power to avenge his death upon them.
Yeah.
So not long after she gets on the throne, there are rumors going around that there's some sort of project, some big project going on upriver. There's a workforce of Ethiopian slaves that go up there every day, and they're coming back, but they don't speak Egyptian, so no one knows what they're doing exactly. The priests think that the secret project is something to do with making amends to them or to their god, Osiris.
Yeah.
A great temple to their god. Maybe that's what she's doing. She's building an awesome temple.
I love their optimism. Secret building project? Well, instead of imagining that it's some kind of Versailles-esque palace for her, they just go with, I bet it's an awesome building for our god and all of us. I can kind of see why the pharaoh had disdain for these people.
Oh, yeah.
Fools.
This goes on through the winter and into the spring. Finally, some dudes go and check it out, and it is indeed a temple to Osiris. Nitocris is going to have a big launch event, a huge banquet for the priests of Osiris and all the other important people. There's going to be live entertainment. There's going to be gift bags. It's going to be the event of the year. Everyone is jazzed.
It is kind of a launch party, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's probably some free psychic readings and
somebody doing face painting. So the day of the dedication of the temple is huge and ornate. After the ceremony, there's going to be a great feast and probably group sex. So we're talking orgies here.
The lustful Epicureans were warmed by visualizations of the delightful banquet of copious meats, fruits, luscious delicacies, and other less innocent indulgences. So it's definitely group sex that he's talking about. Yeah.
When the event begins, the queen shows up and everyone goes nuts for her. She's all charms and smiles, not tipping her hand at all. Says no action, no fleeting expression upon her lovely face could have caused anyone to suspect anything except entire amicability in her feelings or her intentions. Now, all these barges show up with all the guests. The priests are loving this. They're starting to think maybe the sacrilege that the pharaoh performed might have been a good thing if it led to this amazing new temple and this awesome feast.
spinning it positive.
Yeah,
you know, we
exactly.
thought that this was a big offense and was going to cause desert monsters, but look, it's an orgy. Things did turn out all right.
So outside, the temple has amazing architecture and craftsmanship, tens across the board. Inside, it's even more lavish and beautiful. The sacramental vessels are full of gold and the most glorious of fruits. Ah, yes, a splendid place for the making of sacrifices. Gloated the staring priests.
Ah, yes, indeed, agreed the queen, smiling with half-crossed eyes. It was a splendid place for sacrifices, especially for the human sacrifice that had been planned.
It says half-crossed eyes? Is that a typo?
I don't know what that means.
Half-closed eyes, I could see. You know, like maybe she's
yeah, it could be. I don't know where I copied this out of, so it could be a typo. What is half? If they're half-crossed, doesn't that just mean they're looking straight ahead? I don't know.
Is that one eye kind of going in a bit and the other one
yeah,
looking straight?
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
And I don't understand why she would do that. So I'm guessing that's a typo.
It is. But this is, again, it's written by a 16-year-old. So that just might have sounded cool to him. And who knows?
So the ceremony of dedication takes all afternoon. And when it's over, the food cooking can be smelled and everyone is dying to get in there. Strangely, however, the food smells are coming from a subterranean room. Mm. Not typical temple construction, but these are some hungry priests, so, you know, whatever. It says, such vaults were decidedly uncommon among the Egyptians. The idea of feasting in one was novel and appealing.
See, this is where my claustrophobia would be a superpower. Wait, the party's in a basement?
No.
I'm just going to hang out at Egyptian Denny's and we can meet up afterwards because I ain't going down there. She wouldn't get me.
No, you dodged that one. Now, there's a huge spread, live music, open bar. It's like heaven. Everyone starts out just eating and being respectful, but it's not long before the booze lifts inhibitions and dancing starts and the laughing. Then the frolicking begins, first light frolicking and then some heavy frolicking. And it's only a matter of time before full orgy.
This isn't something you're reading into the text either. It's not like suggested as it was earlier.
Yeah, no.
The songs and the laughter, the dancing and the wild frolicking grew less and less restrained until the banquet became a delirious orgy.
It's not subtext, it's text. The queen just sits on her dais and she watches all of these idiots. She would look at their indulgences, but then she would focus on the left wall.
In her mind, the queen Nitocris was seeing a ghastly picture. It was the picture of a room of orgy and feasting suddenly converted into a room of terror and horror. Human beings one moment drunken and lustful, the next screaming in the seizure of sudden and awful death. If any of those present had been empowered to see also that picture of dire horror, they would have clambered wildly to make their escape. But none was so empowered. With increasing wildness, the banquet continued into the middle of the night. Some of the banqueters, disgustingly gluttonous, still gorged themselves at the greasy tables. Others lay in drunken stupor or lolled amorously with the slave girls. But most of them, formed in a great irregular circle, skipped about the room in a barbaric, joy-mad dance, dragging and tripping each other in uncouth merriment and making the hall ring with their ceaseless shouts, laughter, and hoarse song. When the hour had approached near to midnight, the queen, who had sat like one entranced, arose from the cushioned dais.
She takes one last look, soaks it in. She wants to remember all of this, and then she leaves.
Her departure made no impression upon the revelers. But that was sad, because I kind of wanted to hear what her excuse would be, you know? Hey, everybody, keep up the orgy. Don't notice me. I have to run home and walk the dog. He's been slinking dejectedly lately. Want to make sure he gets the attention.
After she leaves, she directs the guards to lower, noiselessly, the big stone slab onto the entrance, and she feels not a sliver of guilt. Vengeance, the strongest of passions, made her obdurate as stone.
The queen passed swiftly across the stone floor of the temple toward the front, through which the night wind swept, blowing her cloak in sheenful waves about her tall and graceful figure. The slaves followed after in silent file, well aware of the monstrous deed about to be executed, and without reluctance to play their parts. Not even the few people gathered at Egyptian Denny's suspected what was to happen. So she arrives at this sort of stone pier, which has a scaffold with a big comical lever on it. There's just like a little bit of cartooniness in this.
With her own hand, pulls this lever, and she can hear the water rush from the river into an underground channel. A cry of triumph, wild and terrible enough to make even the hearts of the brutish slaves turn cold, now broke from the lips of the queen. The pharaoh was avenged. Now, the party's still raging. No one suspects anything. The queen isn't missed. The musicians left before the queen did because they were let in on what was going to happen here. But the other slaves weren't.
Yeah.
They're left to die.
Those are some cold musicians.
Oh my God, yeah.
Especially because it sounds like the show went pretty well. There's been plenty of shows I've played in my life where I would have gladly flooded the chamber and killed the entire audience for not praising me. But here.
Yeah.
I mean, they played a rock show and everybody started having an orgy. So that's that's about the best result you can have. And still, they didn't warn anybody.
So not until the wall begins to open do the revelers notice anything. A hush falls over the room and they can hear rushing water. One woman lets out a scream and panic hits. They rush the stairs, but it's sealed up and everyone is just freaking out.
With the ferocity of a lion springing into the arena of a Roman amphitheater to devour the gladiators set there for its delectation, the black water plunged in. Furiously, it surged over the floor of the room, sweeping tables before it and sending its victims, now face to face with their harrowing doom, into a hysteria of terror. In a moment, that icy black water had risen to their knees, although the room was vast. Some fell instantly dead from the shock, or were trampled upon by the desperate rushing of the mob. Tables were clambered upon, lamps and candles were extinguished, brilliant light rapidly faded to twilight, and a ghastly dimness fell over the room as only the suspended lanterns remained lit. And what a scene of chaotic and hideous horror might a spectator have beheld! The gorgeous trumpery of banquet invaded by howling waters of death, gaily dressed merrymakers caught suddenly in the grip of terror, gasps and screams of the dying amid tumult and thickening dark. What more horrible vengeance could Queen Nitocris have conceived than this banquet of death? Not Diablo himself could be capable of anything more fiendishly artistic. Here, in the Temple of Osiris, those nobles and priests who had slain the pharaoh in expiation of his sacrilege against Osiris had now met their deaths. And it was in the waters of the Nile, material symbol of the god Osiris, that they had died. It was magnificent in its irony.
And at this point, the author says he would be happy to end the story here, but there's more, because this is not a tale of fancy, but one of fact. This is a tale from history.
I knew it.
Nitocris was real, told by the Greek historian Herodotus. The morning after the death party, the people get suspicious, and the queen knows that the hammer is going to fall on her eventually. Her chariot is blocked by people wanting to know what happened to everyone at the party. She ignores them and decides to go on into the palace and die not by the mob, but by her own hand.
Therefore, upon her entrance into the palace, she ordered her slaves to fill instantly her boudoir with hot and smoking ashes. When this had been done, she went to the room, entered it, closed the door, and locked it securely, and then flung herself down upon a couch in the center of the room. In a short time, the scorching heat and the suffocating thick fumes of the smoke overpowered her. Only her beautiful dead body remained for the hands of the mob.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end.
Asphyxiated herself because she didn't want to be torn apart by the mob, but also perhaps now that her brother's dead, it's, you know, hard for her to survive as well. So once the vengeance was enacted, why stick around?
Now, unfortunately, as Tennessee Williams believes that the story to be true, a lot of historians believe that it was actually just a myth. It's in a story that Herodotus wrote in his histories book. She would have been the last queen of the sixth dynasty, but there isn't any Egyptian records that corroborate this, that she actually existed.
So we think it's Herodotus mentioned this, but it's not necessarily a true thing that happened.
Yeah.
Although I've heard the name Nitocris before on this show.
Yes.
I believe
Lovecraft mentions it in The Outsider and, of course, Imprisoned with the Pharaohs.
Yeah.
And Lord Dunsany did a play about this specific thing as well called The Queen's Enemies.
Okay. Natakris is somebody that comes up quite a bit, but we don't know if that's a real person or not.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
I hope that it is fictional because I can't think of any more supreme whore. You know, at least there's one guy who's like, I can't believe this is happening. I always wanted to be in an orgy. I never thought I'd have my chance. Like, everybody's doing it. So I'm not going to be in trouble for this. There's no shame to it. I can... Finally, I get my chance. And then drowns. And that's a little too depressing to contemplate if it is in fact real. You know? So I'm glad that you're telling me this isn't necessarily true.
Oh, yeah. It's just a mythical tale. I want to thank Andrew Lieben for doing an exceptional job of reading. Andrew actually has a little message for us since this is our last episode, 601 of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, and he just wanted to give a little message.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Chad. Andrew here. I don't know if you'll have the ability or the desire to edit this into the actual show, but I've been thinking about you guys. If my arithmetic is correct, this is episode 601 of your show, and I just wanted to say, for the record, how proud and impressed I am, and how glad and grateful I am to still be part of this endeavor after over 600 episodes. Great job, great work, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, and I know I speak for a lot of other people. And, as you make the big switch over to strange studies of strange stories, I hope I'm strange enough to continue to be part of the team, because it really means a lot to me. And I just want to say thanks and congratulations and see you for another 600. Okay, bye.
Oh, that's so nice to hear.
We love you, Andrew. You're just great.
Honestly, there's so many people that tune in just to hear Andrew read, and we're just a couple of comics on the side. He really is the third member of the show, and we're so grateful to him for all the work he's done for us. And guess what, folks? He's going to be on the new show as well.
Yeah.
Doing some readings pretty soon. You're going to hear him next month. Thanks, Andrew. That's so nice. He's just the best guy.
He is.
And make sure that you go over to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and pick up all of those insane props for the Call of Cthulhu 40th anniversary re-release. Also, don't forget to pick up The Cults of Cthulhu by Christopher Lackey with Mike Mason. Uh-huh. That's coming out in hardcover. If you don't have it at your local game store, ask them to get it. They will do that for you. I'm looking forward to getting my copy.
Yeah, there's lots of little Easter eggs from our show in there. So if you're a fan of our show and you read it, you'll see a lot of good things in there. So
yeah, we've got a comments show coming up this month as well as a bonus episode. So we'll talk more about the last 13 years on those, but we're not getting too wistful about all of it because we're going to be jumping right into a new set of stories next month as Strange Studies of Strange Stories, which we've been teasing out as a title forever. Uh-huh. So it's not going to be too jarring. Again, if you're a subscriber on Patreon, you're just going to get that in your feed as normal. And I believe we're going to be tackling some Rod Serling to start out with.
Yeah, I'm excited for that.
It's going to be good stuff. So before we go, though, I do also want to thank some of our patrons. And I'm going to start by thanking the King and Jello. Thank you, King and Jello.
I'd like to thank Marilyn Lewis.
Carlos Slater, thank you.
Gabriel, thank you.
Roxy Deluxe, thank you so much.
James Martina, thank you.
Wes Sale, thank you.
Ray Oberg, thank you.
Sandra Price, thanks so much.
And lastly, I want to thank Connor McCord.
Thank you, everybody who supported the show along the way. We're going to be back, as I said, soon with a comments show, and we'll talk more about your contributions. That's all we have for now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Here at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.